Hi, this is Paul. I wasn't sure if I would release Friday's video or not. I made it, and I often have that when I make a video. It's like, is this any good? Is this going to be helpful for anyone? But I read some of the comments, and it seemed to be helpful. One person noted that they really wanted more talk about the new monasticism, and I think that's appropriate because obviously one of the big areas I struggle with is what turns the church will take as we depart from modernity. And I think there's, the rise of modernity and the rise of Protestantism are deeply connected, as is the Enlightenment period and what that has brought. And now, at the recession of modernity, we're going to see some additional moves taking place. So I wanted to do a broader video on transformation identity and the new monasticism. People are undergoing transformation so rapidly and so radically. I don't know if there's been a time in human history where we would find people swapping identities, especially voluntarily, or at least semi-voluntarily, so quickly. I would imagine that many people who are changing identities dramatically, part of the reason they're so insistent that the rest of the culture embrace and affirm their new identities is because their experience is that these changes are in some ways involuntary, that they would have to make it, that somehow they have to make their outsides match their insides in one way or another. But people are undergoing these things so rapidly. Now, in the ancient world, let's say your city lost a war and you would become a slave, or you would marry and then become a wife or a mother or a father, a husband and a father. Well, those are transformations. But the kinds of transformations people are promoting and celebrating now are simply so rapid and radical. So, part of the success of, I think this is partly due to the success of creating a semi-stable context, because people now, well, their food source, you often don't do these transformations threatening your very existence. Some do. But a society can seem to afford to play with the fundamentals, perhaps partly because of our amazing affluence. But I think there will be a carrying capacity with respect to the limited numbers of transformations that can actually happen. Now, this is starting to sound quite esoteric, so maybe I'll get into first the discussion about transformations. Now, this conversation with Jordan Peterson and Brett Weinstein, I didn't do a full commentary on, partly because there were some things I really liked in it, but I didn't really feel it, not like the Peugeot commentary, not like the Peugeot episode. But I keep coming back to it and certain sections of it, and mostly to a lot of the stuff that Jordan was saying. I find Brett to be a little slow in this conversation. So, as the last time I played it, I kind of zipped through a lot of what Brett is saying. But Jordan had a very interesting part in this podcast on transformations that I wanted to bring into this.
So the identity issue is, I mean, it forces us to one of the things I've found so challenging about all of this is that these challenges to fundamental assumptions force you to make arguments for things you actually don't know how to argue for. So, for example,
That's a really interesting observation. They force you to make arguments for things you don't know how to argue for. And I think that would be things that we sort of assume they're just assumptions, and now suddenly we have to argue for our assumptions. And they were just simply assumptions, and in some cases almost presuppositions, and we had no arguments for them generated because they were simply an assumed part of the background. And a little bit later, I'm going to get into you sort of an agent arena relationship here, that when, in a sense, the arena changes so dramatically, you lose your identity and you don't know where you are. A different part of this video, another part that I just quickly tried to find it and I couldn't find it quickly, Peterson notes that people can only tolerate so much disruption. And when they lose that disruption, you know, things really become unglued for people. And I've seen this in pastoral ministry. I've seen people, things happen to people that completely upend them emotionally. But that comment Peterson made, I think, is terribly important.
What does it mean? You ask to fundamental assumptions, force you to make arguments for things you actually don't know how to argue for. So, for example, what does it mean to be female? Well, I don't know, because no one's actually ever asked me that question. They just act being female and I act being male, whatever that means. And we don't ever sit down and lay out the explicit assumptions. Now
this is really key, because most of us would say, well, I've spent all of my life either being female or being in community with female. My mother was a female, and yet describe it. And this gets into the fact that we have all of this first draft beneath us. And it's unarticulated, it's mapped in some way, but it's only mapped at certain layers and not at others. It's not mapped at the layer of, let's say, in the left brain, where it's mapped and articulated and digested and codified, let's say. But it is very much mapped, and so we can say yes, no, and usually we don't experience that. That what we experience more of is sort of comfort or disturbance.
You do that to some degree when you're arguing with your wife about who's going to do what when, and maybe with your mother and with your sister. You have local discussions when roles come into conflict, but you never list the axioms that you're using to do your perceptual categorization. And so then when you're forced to defend your presumption, you don't know how to do it because you don't have the arguments at hand. So to be female,
because you've never developed the arguments, because you've never needed them, you've just lived them out.
Well, I mean, means something like, and what do you do? I had a discussion with one of my students, former students today. We're trying to help people develop this. We're trying to develop this program that helps people identify and then accomplish important life tasks. And
Now, what's interesting about this list, and I think it's actually a great list, we haven't needed that list. Why haven't we needed that list? Because that list has been encoded into our culture, and it was just the next thing to do. My wife always found it annoying that I only applied to one college. I only applied to Calvin College, now Calvin University. Why only to that college? Because for me, that was the next thing you did. And my wife's like, no, you should have applied to many colleges and chose. Why? I knew where I was going. That was the next thing I did. I didn't need to think about it. I just did it. And there's a certain freedom in there, because you don't have to spend your time and your mind thinking about the next thing, because we have limited resources and we have limited time and we have limited energy. One person in another podcast said that, you know, it was such a relief when they got married, because this whole area of their life of dating and relationships and romance, it was all settled. Boom. Now you can focus on other things. And we have limited resources, and you know, where Peterson is going to go is that when you have such foundational, fundamental things that are occupying all of your life, when you have to make everything up, well, it's just you have limited bandwidth, and you're just not going to be able to do other things. You're as a human being, you're just not going to be terribly productive.
It's forced me to think about something I've thought about over years. What are the important life tasks? Like, okay, so you should get educated to the approximate level of your intelligence. You should be employed gainfully, have a job, or maybe if you're lucky, a career. You need an intimate relationship. You should have some friends. You need a family. You need to regulate the world of temptation, drug and alcohol use, that sort of thing. You have to take care of your health. You need to make some productive use of your time outside of work. So there's eight things. Maybe there's more, but that's sort of eight. And maybe you don't need to be fully accomplished along all of those eight, but they're pretty important and they're not a bad start. And if you can come up with a better list, more power to you. But, well, let's take one. You're going to have a family, an intimate relationship and a family. Well, the classical way of doing that is that someone's male and someone's female, and they get together and they have children, and then they have grandchildren, and that's like a third of your life, or a quarter of your life, or a fifth of your life. I don't care. It's some non-trivial portion of your life. And that identity, male and female, is a precondition to that route through life. And then you have children and they mean something to you and they give you something to do, and you have grandchildren and it's the same thing. So by playing out male and female, it's sort of like you've now occupied 25% of your time productively. That's the role. Okay, let's say we blow that apart. Well, then what? What are we supposed to do then? Because you can't pretend that into existence. And that's the postmodern element of this. This is the refusal of the real world. It's like,
well, you can't pretend it into existence. And in fact, what you have to do is reconstruct it. And most of us spent the first few years of our life basically constructing how we can move our hands and where our body is and all of this stuff. But this reconstruction, and this is what we have going on in our society, this reconstruction intersects with so many other institutions and functions and people that that's an enormous cost in society. And right now, the irony is that we're in some ways renegotiating and saying that we must rebuild society at all of these basic foundational levels for all of this all of these transitions. And if we weren't doing this, what else might we be doing? And these transitions are the kinds of things that if you ignore the people and say, okay, well, we've got these people that are going through these transformations and they're all out there, we'll just leave them alone. And increasingly that happens because you just get tired. But this group of people then says, no, you can't ignore us anymore. These are our demands. Okay, those are your demands. But I can basically just ignore you. No, you can't ignore us. And then you climb up the stairs of power and you make the entire country pay attention to you, which you think would be a good idea, until they in fact start paying attention to you and their attention comes with demands. And it says, oh, you want to have a conversation? Okay, let's talk. And basically the way it goes is once they sort of get what they want, say, no more conversation. It's like, well, you got my attention already. So actually, if it's a negotiation that you want, I actually have things that I'm going to bring to the negotiation, some of my own demands and some of my own requests and some of my own things from you, because that's what happens with negotiation. And if, in fact, I never paid attention to you, I would probably leave you alone. So do you really want to rebuild society, or do you want to be left alone? Choice is yours, sort of, but, you know, at some point other people just sort of walk away and go into holes.
Okay, we'll make identity entirely mutable, but what are the trans kids that came after me in the first demonstration against me? I said, you think I'm your enemy, but I'm not. And the reason I said that, being a clinician, was because I thought, well, you're adopting an identity that there is no rules for. What the hell are you going to do with that? You're inviting so much trouble into your life, you can't even possibly imagine it, because you won't know what to do. And people won't know how to treat you.
And that's the key one. People won't know how to treat you. And especially if every time, because they don't know how to treat you, so then they try something, usually from their set menu. So they try something from their set menu, and you're offended because this hasn't been all of the stuff that you've been developing. And so then you react angrily. Well, they'll probably do one or two things. They'll either sort of cave in a small thing because it doesn't cost them much. Let's say a pronoun. Okay, I'll use any pronoun you want me to use. I don't care. But that's the point. I don't care. I use any pronoun you want me to. I don't care. I'll call you whatever you'd like. I don't care. But at some point, there's going to be something that the other person says, no, I'm not willing to go there. And, well, now what do you do? And they might say, well, I'm just simply going to walk away from you because you're simply too much bother, and I don't care enough about you to deal with the drama. That's what people do. And not just with any of these current social issues. That's generally what they do in life. If you have someone that is a lot of drama in your life and you get to a point that you can't take their drama anymore, you walk away. or you wall yourself off, or you do something, you go away, and then when the other person says, well, I need this from you, depart from me, I never knew you. That's what happens.
So where does that leave you? Now, you might say, well, I'm so distraught about the discordance between my psychological state and my biological reality that pales in comparison. And maybe there are situations where that's the case, but man, an identity that doesn't solve the problem of how you're going to live isn't an identity.
That's really key. Another thing that's going to happen is that, so you recode a lot of society according to the demands of this minority. Well, as is always the case in the recoding, people are going to look at that and say, there might be opportunities for me in that. Especially if they're not coded very thoroughly. And then you're going to have others simply jump in and take advantage of the new coding, because that's what people do. We see opportunities and obstacles. And so when we see opportunities, and other people say, no, that's illegitimate. It depends how you coded it. So you won't know how to live.
So, man, an identity that doesn't solve the problem of how you're going to live isn't an identity.
And right there, you also have the sense of an identity is function of an arena. And the identity resolves questions of how to live within the specific arena. You know, this is the agent arena relationship that Verveke talks about. I am a father within a family. And so that identity as father gives me roles and lets me know how to behave. Now, we've in our culture had a lot of disruption of this, you know, and a lot of it due to changes in technology, changes in culture, changes in economics. I mean, there's been a lot of disruption. And so, and people have been calling, well, we need to disrupt these categories. Okay. But again, we all started out with a first draft inside of us. And we are very malleable, capable people of editing and rewriting drafts. But new drafts are what Peterson is going to call transformations. And these drafts are not just individual to myself. They have connectors out into other people and institutions. And so this is not a small thing. And again, the more time you have to work on all of these other things, the less time you have for everything else and anything else that might be of value. So if you choose to spend all of your time rewriting the basic code, well, there's lots of other code that's simply never going to be written.
I don't know what it is, but it's not an identity.
Yep.
I don't even know how people would change the rules exactly to make that work.
So I agree with you wholeheartedly that...
Now, I just notice in this conversation that Peterson just seems to be clipping along. and whenever we hit Brett, it's kind of like whoosh. I don't mean to make a big deal of it, but, you know, when I make this video, it kind of impacts what I play. So now I'm going to pause and see.
Effectively, our identities are means to an end. And there are conservation laws that apply to the system as a whole. And unfortunately, yes. And this is actually essentially the core argument of the book that Heather and I have just completed. But the core argument is we are living in a period of evolutionary hypernovelty, where human beings are actually the species for which we have the best tools to deal with novel circumstances that our ancestors did not know anything about, but that the rate of change has become so high that there is no conceivable...
Okay, novelty, that's too broad. It's correct, but it needs a little higher resolution. Because again, Peterson was just talking about identity, which again is a function of an agent and an arena. And so novelty... You know,
way for us to keep up with it. And what we are effectively watching with this idea, even in principle.
Yeah.
that, you know, the very fact that you can say the environment that we live in is not the one that we were born into, that's way too fast. You may be able to make a discrete jump. You know, human beings are capable of moving from one habitat to another and
Okay. I'm going to, again, he's talking like a biologist and Peterson is talking like a psychologist. Habitat change. And what we're really talking about is a first draft, a much more foundational coding change inside of you. How do I respond within this arena as an agent towards some end?
Figuring out one time what the rules of the new habitat are, but yeah. A habitat that is constantly in motion,
yeah.
And has become utterly arbitrary with respect to even the most fundamental characteristics is not something to which we can be well adapted, which is causing us
to be...
Sounds
like a powerful argument for conservatism.
It is.
Yeah, it's I know. 100%. I understand. Well, I do understand. I do understand that. That is, to the degree that I'm conservative in my outlook, that is the reason. It's like, look, I've kept up, you know, like I've transformed myself multiple times over the years. And I was taken out by this illness. And it isn't obvious to me that I can catch up again.
Now, that's interesting because he uses transformations in a number of ways. In his conversation with David Nasser, he really focused on that, on the essence of, on transformation, because he was sort of wondering about Christian conversion, and he was talking about substance abuse and some of those issues. And now, you know, it's a little bit different context here.
I've caught up a lot, and I've watched my peers, my high school classmates, my university classmates, and I've seen people who don't have one transformation in them. There are people who, they adapt to the high school environment and that's it.
And I think this is right. I'd make the same, I'm about the same age as Peterson, and I'd make exactly the same comment. I know people that they adapted to high school and that's it. Or they are the same person that they have been for 40 years, at least in my case. The same person they've been for 40 years. And it's not necessarily a bad thing, but you can tell.
That's where they are for the rest of their life. They peak at 17, they're done. They don't change. And then I've seen people who can manage one transformation. I've seen people, much rarer, who can manage two or three. But after that, it's like, it gets massive drop off in probability with every demand for transformation.
Massive drop-off in probability for every demand of transportation. And again, I think this is, I mean, so Apple released its M1 processor. And, you know, Apple has hopped, you know, they hopped into the Intel world. Now, this is a little nerdy for some of you, I know, but I understand it. They hopped into the Intel world, and then they hopped out of the Intel world. And when, I don't have an M1 right now, but when they hopped out of it, what they did was they had this basically this translation software, and there's different ways to do it. They basically translate the x86 code into their new ARM code, and off they go. And it worked very, very well on the M1. Microsoft has had sort of a different layer that hasn't worked anywhere near as well as the M1 layer that, you know, they have their ARM Surface and yada, yada, yada. My point here is that with multiple transformations, Peterson is asserting that a person's capacity, let's say you have your first draft inside, and now there's such things in the ancient world as a palimpsest. Basically, you wash because, you know, paper was expensive, and or they used skin, so you wash it and you make a new text on top. And what modern scholars have done, if they want to see the text underneath, is there are different light processes that can look at the text underneath to try and expose the text underneath, because that's older and it might be even rarer than the text that is written on top. But in a sense, what we do is you don't really reformat the hard drive. And you don't want to do that because in a human being because there's massive amounts of information. You just sort of want to selectively upgrade the operating system. And Peterson's point is there's only so many layers that and people have different capacities for this. There's only so much transformation you can do. And in fact, I would argue that this is almost a definition of trauma. Because I would say that each transformation will in some ways do trauma to the drafts underneath. And that's why they are limited. And to get back to the point of this video, people are entering into this very young and having tremendously traumatic transformations. Barry Weiss posted on Twitter a very powerful story of Kira Bell. And she tells her story. My earliest days, my home life was unhappy. My parents, a white English woman and a black American who got together while he was in Britain with the U.S. Air Force, divorced when I was about 5. So you've already got trauma built in there. My mother, who was on welfare, descended into alcoholism and mental illness. Although my father remained in England, he was emotionally distant to me and my younger sister. I was a classic tomboy, which was one of the healthiest parts of my life in Letchworth, a town of about 30,000 people, an hour outside London. Early in childhood, I was accepted by the boys. I dressed typically boys' clothing and was athletic. I never had an issue with my gender. It wasn't on my mind, which is exactly, in my opinion, how it should be with a child. She's a little girl. My wife tells me all the time when she was a little girl, she was a tomboy. That's just, you know, the boys had more fun. They were out there playing and, you know, playing in the brook and out there doing things. And so a very common story of a little girl. Then puberty hit and everything changed for the worse. A lot of teenagers, especially girls, have a hard time with puberty. But I didn't know this because you're a child. You don't know anything. Your first draft is very limited and it keeps getting added to as you go. I thought I was the only one who hated how my hips and breasts were growing. Then my period started and they were disabling. I was often in pain and drained of energy. And again, not uncommon for, you know, menstrual cramps and, you know, all of this stuff. I've got a wife and 2 girls. I know all about this stuff. Also, I could no longer pass as one of the boys, so lost my community of male friends. And this is a common story. You can find lots of movies about this and lots of stories about this. And, you know, and often in movies a couple of decades ago, you know, the tomboy, she transitions, but then she becomes, and the relationship between the boys and the girls change. And at some point they negotiate that and come to a, you know, you used to be one of the guys, but now there's whole new possibilities that, you know, girl, but maybe, you know, we negotiate these things. I didn't feel I belonged to the girls either. My mother's alcoholism had gotten so bad that I didn't want to bring friends home. Eventually, I had no friends to invite. I became more alienated and solitary, and I've been moving a lot too, and had to start over at different schools. So you've got little transformations that are going on. Every time you go to a new school as a kid, well, it's an opportunity for a fresh start, but you also sort of, they don't know you yet, so all of that negotiating. By the time I was 14, I was severely depressed and had given up. I stopped going to school. Again, look at her family background, of course. Her father's abandoned her. Her mother has abandoned her, but not abandoned her enough, so now she has to deal with all the problems of her mother. I stopped going to school. I stopped going outside. I stayed in my room, avoiding my mother, playing video games, getting lost in my favorite music, and surfing the internet. Ah, the internet. Everything else was happening. I became attracted to girls. I had never had a positive association with the term lesbian or the idea that 2 girls could be in a relationship. This made me wonder if there was something inherently wrong with me. Around this time, out of the blue, my mother asked if I wanted to be a boy. Well, there's a new idea. Something that hadn't even crossed my mind. And then I found some websites about females transitioning to male. Shortly after, I moved in with my father and his then partner. And she asked me the same question my mother had. So it's out there in the culture, now becomes a possibility, presented to this young woman, and bang. And that sets a whole bunch of things in motion. The National Health Service, yada, yada, yada. And you can read the whole thing. Hope I remember to include the link in the notes. Maybe I'll just do that a minute so I don't forget.
And now, I find myself now, I have to rely on my son for doing some of my technological chores. And I hate that because I stayed on top of it for so long. But I got sick and I fell out. And it isn't obvious to me that I can clamber back in. It's very difficult.
Well, if you'll take some advice from a friend, and I'm not even sure.
And we'll stop it there. You can listen to the whole thing. So let's assume there's a limit to the number of transformations that one can endure. There's only so much rewriting and recoding. There's only so much in these little SSDs that we have inside of us. There's a limited number of read-writes you can do, the limited number of writing over things, limited number of washing the sheet and recoding various elements, and we're limited. Every break in the narrative comes with a reputational and identity carrying and a biological cost. And for this one particular person, it's been a tremendous cost. People are burning through them younger and younger. You know, to start this journey at 24 and to live it through 14 and to live it through 23, it's a lot of trauma. It's trauma to your body. It's wear and tear. Likely have diminished capacities later in life. You don't, there's a reason we call these things scars. Now, again, as I mentioned in my other video, I've watched some of these videos of this God is Gray, and, you know, Peterson's point that, okay, so fair enough, they're rejecting a programming that they inherited. And again, I want to be enormously, I mean, to one degree or another, people would push back on some of these things and say, you know, the church betrayed them. And fair enough. You know, again, this slide that I've used at various times, when you look at the Ravi Zacharias story, Christianity wants to bear witness to the fullness of life, but the inability to live its own sexual ethic up and down the hierarchy causes deep dissonance and I think provokes deconstruction. In the case of at least the limited number of videos that I've seen of this God is Gray, she was deep into purity culture and this certain strange element of evangelicalism, and then she has a transformation and she goes to reject it. And so now she's, you know, sleeping with her boyfriend, and then oops, she gets pregnant, and, you know, she has a video, how to lose your virginity. And so, but again, now sort of on these platforms, she's a very attractive, well-spoken young woman. And for the same reason that they put women on the cover of women's magazines at the supermarket checkout, other young women are going to go, and she's going to be an expert because she's a being of light, just like Paul Vanderclay is an expert because he's a being of light. Maybe Paul Vanderclay doesn't know much. You'll find plenty of people who will say that too. So it's just the way it is. But here we are. We're making stuff up, and we're trying to get through. You don't know how to live. And so then she has, I haven't seen any of the newer ones. I assume she had the child. I don't know that she gave the child up for adoption, but she was unmarried and she wasn't going to marry. And, well, just having a child with my boyfriend doesn't mean that we should marry. Well, yeah, maybe not, but I have 5 children and I know something of what it takes to raise children, and it's a lot of work. And even today, there's always some remapping that has to go on because, again, each, if you're married, the husband and the wife both have maps from childhood. But if you, the boy has the mapping of the father and the woman has the mapping of the mother and the cross mappings as well, too. But obviously, the more changes you put into that, if it's 2 men or 2 women or it's a single mom, or the more remappings you put into there, the more you burn through your capacity to do so. And, you know, so Mike the therapist, Sack Ryder, you know, working on a new ethical system for sexuality, we don't just do these things ourselves. We do them in community. And community always has a degree of tolerance for change inside of it, but that degree of tolerance is limited. And so, you know, what Peterson says here is very, very right, because part of the way we survive is because we received a cultural script from a previous generation that always needs some amendment and adaptation, but we usually do so. But if you have to write the whole thing again, you're just not going to have time for a whole lot of what's else, and you're going to burn a tremendous amount of your limited capacity in writing it. And that's part of the reason we share and do YouTubes, and you can go to Tumblr or Twitter or Facebook or Instagram, and you will be remapped. That's what these things are doing. But it all comes at a cost. Now, I want to do a little portion here in the video that sort of lends a little perspective to where we are, because you go all the way back to Renaissance humanism, which really sort of was the context out of which the Protestant Reformation grew, because it was a return to the text, as Philip Carey says in his Philosophy and Religion in the West course, which is something that I used quite a bit earlier in my videos here. It's a wonderful course in the Great Courses series. And so you have Erasmus, who is, you know, now he's comparing, suddenly the printing press is available, so texts are quite a bit cheaper. So suddenly all of this change is happening, and this is feeding a tremendous amount of change and disruption in the world. And you very much have the loosening grip of church tyranny and changes in the political context. Now remember, the Reformation doesn't take in France and Spain and Italy, but it does take in Germany and the Netherlands and Switzerland and eventually in England, and through England it will export to the Americas, and through England it'll export all around the world. But you have an explosion of, you don't really have an explosion, you have an addition of platforms at that point, and the loosening, and so change starts to come in, and so you already have some changes in mappings that are coming about, and again these changes are in some ways traumatic. And they lead to the wars of the reformational period. And so you have the Peace of Augsburg, which is an earlier peace where they decide, okay, if you're in the Holy Roman Empire, then the principality, the prince of the particular district and the ruler of the district gets to decide whether they're Lutheran or Catholic. Okay. And then later, you know, that's going to be insufficient. So you're going to have the 30 Years' War, which is very much a war that sort of surrounds the Habsburgs. And the lines aren't cleanly Protestant and Catholic, but it does have a degree of importance in that war. And then you have the Peace of Westphalia. And this just clipped from Wikipedia. You know, Joaquin Whaley, a leading English language historian of the Holy Roman Empire, mentions that later commentators such as Leibniz, Rousseau, and Kant and Schiller eulogize the Peace of Westphalia as the first step towards universal peace. You already see that the Enlightenment is taking root. Why? Well, because Luther's idea and the Reformation idea of just turning to the text is found insufficient to achieve the kind of consensus necessary for all of the mappings to work together. And so, you know, agree to disagree, that's sort of what these wars are about. But they want to look for a deeper basis, a deeper foundation that can be universally between Catholic and Protestant. And so you see this pursuit of philosophy through empiricism and rationalism. And maybe we can sort of outflank the texts and gain a deeper footing. And you really have the birth of the vision of modernity. And I think now at the end of modernity, and as postmodernity eats into and undermines modernity, that really is where Peterson steps in, because what he is looking to do, whereas many in early modernity worked very hard to, because you can't do a full-blown cultural transformation. That's incredibly chaotic, disruptive, bloody, dangerous. And so everyone's trying to preserve Christianity as they're trying to add the new. And so for 500 years, you have this swapping in and out until you get to sort of Darwin and Freud and the 19th and the 20th century, where you have some radical transitions. And obviously with globalism, you've got more pluralism to contend with, and pluralism continues to be a challenge to the texts. And again, empiricism and rationalism was supposed to address pluralism, but postmodernity comes and says, now, wait a minute, you can't really get rid of this seer in this. And all of those seers have agendas of their own. And so this trick doesn't really work anymore like it used to. And so now, just as in early modernity, they're trying to preserve Christianity, what you have in the IDW and in a variety of things is you're trying to preserve science. Say, okay, well, let's not lose science in this process. And in many ways, one way to understand Jordan Peterson's work is an attempt to ask the question, how shall we live? Okay. We need to know how to live. We need to preserve these mappings. And so evolutionary psychology tries to outflank, and you can see because, okay, in modernity, you have this monarchical vision of empiricism and reason. And so we're dealing with empiricism and reason objectively. And postmodernity comes along and says, that's a load of BS. You're not doing anything objective. Science doesn't say anything. Scientists say things, and scientists have biases, and you're not going to get around it. So now you have to go back and include the scientist. You have to include the human being in the seeing of the world. And, you know, again, Peterson, a space modernity says the world is a space for objects, but now we're going to say this is a forum for action, brings in the pragmatists, talks as a psychologist, and says, well, if we're going to include the person again, we need to understand the psychology of the person and the development of the person and the formation of the person. And so one way to understand Jordan Peterson's work and really what separates him from, say, Pinker and even Brett Weinstein and many of the others is Peterson, you can sort of line them up on a spectrum, but Peterson is saying we need to include the person. The people need to be included. And so Peterson's trying to keep modernity and the person together, and that's brings in Jung and of course all the Peterson stuff, but he's trying to provide a platform to again outflank postmodernity and say, okay, if we're going to include the person, this is what we know about people, and that has to be included in the picture. But these agents who are doing the work are also functioning within an arena, and your agency is a function of the arena, and your agency is a function of your identity. And so what we've had is this with the internet. I mean, it's the printing press on steroids, and it's platform radical multiplication. Just pulled up an article recently. It was how Tumblr taught social justice to a generation of teenagers. Tumblr was a huge influence in girls in transitioning in all sorts of things. And whereas before people would be informed and socialized by their peers, you had authority structures. And in modernity, you had the attempt of using empiricism, rationalism, which sort of comes together in sort of a science. Well, now you've got the complete loss of authority. And now we have radical, massive transformation. You have these enormous rises in gender dysphoria, and we have no idea why. Are they caused by hormones in plastics? Are they caused by social? Is it a social contagion? Not unlike, let's say, suicide can be a social contagion. You know, what on earth is causing this? And you can't rule out the arena, the social arena. And again, if you follow most narratives, this comes at, you know, I did that video on exegeting, Pope Joe's Easter sermon, you know, the secret sacred self. Well, deep inside of me, there's a pristine, untouched, perfect human being I call my true self. And that true self has all these aspects, and it's very Rousseauian. You know, all of the stuff, all of the corruption of the world has covered up my true self. And so now via what? Via just intuitions and intonations, my true self is going to emerge. Well, what we're seeing is that, oh, you forgot psychology and sociology. You forgot all of the fact that perhaps you are in fact formed, and these might be functions of other things going on. And just because you say you have a true self underneath there doesn't necessarily make it so. And the rapid multiple transformations that you are going through and burning through in your life, where are they going to lead you? Are you basically going to, once you hit your 30s or 40s, keel over in exhaustion because you've been how many different gender identities and you've attempted how many different relationships? And now, especially with sort of the giving up on marriage, you've decided that to be rootless is the best opportunity, but you've basically spent all of your life trying to work on the basic fundamentals of who you are, and you haven't had any time to develop anything else. And the people around you, because they're all busy with their own stuff, basically got sick of all the transitions and said, you do you. I'm out. I see that. I see that with addicts. I see that with homeless people. You know, family loves them and family bonds are strong, but at some point the family says to their mentally ill or their alcoholic son or daughter and says, you do you, just not here. Out you go. I can't take it anymore. There's only so much disruption I can handle. And I need to, for self-preservation, I'm going to put a wall up and I'm going to have rules around you. We're building secular monastic movements. So when you look at the timing of the rise of monastic movements, it's enormously complicated, and this is a terrible simplification, but at least in the West, you have, in late antiquity, the old order, the old Roman order collapsing. And in my conversation with Rafe Kelly that hasn't been published yet, I made the point to him, you know, you listen to Steven Pinker and some of these guys, and they make it sound like Christianity was just this intrusion into the classical period, and it derailed it. Well, read good history from late antiquity. It was collapsing. And Christianity was, you know, it's sort of like Christianity's coming down the street and all the people are abandoning their houses because they can no longer keep them up. And the Christians in the house saying, well, I guess it's mine now. Everyone else is just kind of coming unglued. And, you know, Constantine embraces Christianity because they're looking for one God to rule them all. Augustine mocked late antiquity's God system, and it was simply unworkable. Tom Holland talks about that in, you know, Whether the Greeks Had Religion, that YouTube video that I've linked to often. So in late antiquity, the old Roman order continues to slowly collapse. And those who don't see the Enlightenment within Christendom like to imagine Christian corruption of the classical world. But again, read C.S. Lewis's The Discarded Image. What happens in a way is Christianity basically takes over classical antiquity and buttresses it and changes it and preserves it all through the Middle Ages. And if you want to know what destroys the classical world, it's not Renaissance humanism. They exalt it in the classical world. It's basically the Enlightenment that says the classical world isn't enough. We need empiricism and rationalism. We need to imagine we can wield the world through a monarchical vision, a view from nowhere. We can see things as they are. It's a world of objects. Objects are what is, and we've been dealing with this for 500 years, and there was no need for a God in there. So what happens, though, in the early stages of that collapse is monasteries. Well, why? Because life is just unlivable. So you put up walls. Monasteries had walls. They're semi-permeable. Monasteries try to heal the world, but monasteries, it's like if I see this all the time with people who live very disordered lives, and so you say, join the army. Well, why? Well, when you go into the army gives you a rule. And there's a structure that is outside of you. And if you go young enough, you can imprint that structure from you. And I've seen many people, you know, they get out of the army and they clean their room. And they organize themselves, and they're determined, and they know how to lead, and they know how to do things because they were in the army. The army taught them structure. Well, monasteries did that, and they had their walls, and they had their rules, and you had probably two kinds of people in the monastery: people who couldn't cope in the outside world, and spiritual athletes. And together, it's a perfect combination in a lot of ways. And it's basically what happens in a lot of churches as churches get small like this one. You basically have the most committed and the most dysfunctional. And the reason that works is because the most committed can handle the most dysfunctional. A lot of times people think, well, put all the dysfunctional people together. That's called a group home in California. It doesn't work. You have the most committed and the most dysfunctional, and the dysfunctional borrow the functionality from the most committed, and they can sort of make things go. And so the monasteries grow, and the monasteries grow wealthy and successful in some ways. And Protestantism basically sacks the monasteries, both literally and figuratively, because what the Swiss Reformation wants to do is basically turn cities into monasteries. Well, that's a tall order. But they really try hard. And, you know, sometimes with some tyranny and brutality, you know, the Puritans are going to make you go to church. And they're going to put you in the stocks. But, you know, the Puritans also had a lot of good things going for them. I mean, just read Puritan history. It's very interesting stuff. But that's the goal, to basically say, okay, let's have the whole city be a holy city. And instead of having a class of monks that we maybe support, let's have the preachers make all of us holy. And we're going to do it through teaching. And we're going to do it now instead of monks writing scriptures. Now with the printing press, you all can have a Bible. And you're going to come to church. And we're going to study the Bible. And it sounds like a Protestant church, doesn't it? Yes, it does. And so you have the reduction of the fringes, and Peugeot talks about that, where, you know, it's no more fringes, no more monsters, no more outliers, no more feast days and fasting days, and all of these rhythms get disrupted, and it's very much the spirit of modernity. And again, you know, the Council of Trent comes along and kind of does that in the Roman Catholic Church, and talked about that with Peugeot and Andrea video that's, depending on when I release this video, that might have already come out. But now modernity is waning, and its order is waning. And, well, this is on the level of people. People are, well, I don't know who I am. I'm looking for this secret, sacred self. And right now I think that's me, but time is a very big function of this. Because if you don't have narrative continuity through your life, well, I see people who radically don't have that. They're called schizophrenics. And, well, I've got you know, between these years I was a man, between these years I was a woman, between these years I was a husband, between these years I was this kind of worker. You know, depending on the level of identity and the arena that you're in, this stuff can be really difficult. I was doing some reflection today on churning. Now, this is a word I get from the tech podcasts I listen to, because like Disney Plus and Paramount Plus and HBO Max and all of these platforms are all concerned about the churning. Well, what's the churning? Well, churning is people who say, oh, I want to watch The Mandalorian, so I'm going to get in Disney Plus. And then when the season is over, they're out. And so basically all these streaming platforms are like, how can we keep the people in? And, you know, now having a YouTube channel, it's very interesting because, you know, there's some, I mentioned before, you know, so there's some diehards like Anselman and Vixen Dixon. I mean, these folks seem to be here for the duration. I mean, they're committed. They're here. But a lot of others sort of come and go, oh, and I see that with myself. You know, for a while, I'm really excited about listening to this person. Then they become map territory and I go into someone else. And of course, YouTube sort of stays there. And I come in and go out and come in and go out. And YouTube says, well, I don't care as long as you stay in YouTube, because all these social media platforms just kind of want to keep us in them and to not have us churn through. But that churning happens too through MySpace and Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and TikTok and Tumblr, and, you know, because there's churning in that too. But all of this churning is also connected from the inside to the outside. And, well, now I'm an Instagram person. Well, now I'm a Facebook person. Well, now I'm a YouTube person. Well, now I'm a Jordan Peterson fan. Well, now I'm a Peter Rollins fan. Well, now I'm a Paul Vanderclay fan. Now I'm a Jonathan Peugeot fan. Now I'm listening to Brett Weinstein. Well, Eric Weinstein stopped his podcast. He's churning all by himself. And pastors have been noticing this in churches. I mean, there are pastors called grazers. I want to go to this church for the Bible study. I want to go to this church for the worship. I want to go to this church for because they do a Christmas program. But I'm not going to be members of any of them. I'm not really going to commit financially to any of them. And at some point, pastors look at them and say, you can come and sit in the chair, but I'm not going to give you any attention. And now suddenly we have like Patreon levels of support. I mean, if you come and you tithe, then you'll get pastoral care. But if I don't know you by name, well, you're out of luck. And this is all a function of this rootlessness. And I think what's going to develop will again be a new monasticism. So my friend Phil Reinders has this website, Habitus Community. I thought I put the link in there. Oh, I did put the link in there. And it's sort of, you know, a redemptive community of practices. And, you know, when I talk about practices, when I talk about the Verveke side, I said, this has been Christian, hot Christian lingo now for 20 years. Dallas Willard, spiritual formation. The stuff has been around a while in the Christian community because the Christian community knew that you need practices, you need walls, you need commitment, you've got Urban Abbey that will be, you know, hopefully going to with Peugeot and Verveke and doing a thing there. A redemptive community of practice, organizing our lives around the way of Jesus through a common rule of life. And it's like, these are the spiritual ancestors of the people who sacked the monasteries. They're still sacking the monastery. Now they're taking the intellectual property and applying it themselves. This is in some ways the triumph of the monastery 500 years later. We devote ourselves to the recovery of regular but radical Christianity, seeking the renewal of the church and its mission in the world. And, you know, vision, rule of life, so you can click on their rule of life. A goal of having a rule is not to achieve a balanced life per se, but to live with Christ at the center, as the center of all that we do. And you got some little videos, and the link will be here, and you have some books you can read. But again, this has been going around in circles around me for quite a while. And again, Roman Catholics and Orthodox will say, oh yeah, well, this is all familiar and you guys are just starting this. We know how to do this because we never stopped doing this. Yeah, we ransacked some of your monasteries and now we're getting your intellectual property and we're taking that too. But the monastics are always alongside sort of the regular church. And I'm by no means well-versed. And I look at the Roman Catholic clergy system and it's like, well, what kind of clergy are you? Well, I'm secular. What does that mean? It means I work in this church down the road. Oh, okay. In the seculum. Oh, okay. I get it. And you're a monastic and you're over here and you're over there because, you know, the Roman Catholic Church is a huge ancient thing. And Protestants, where we're just playing around with it and doing it all in our Protestant way. And, you know, Rod Dreher's Benedict option kind of pointing that in the same way. But for my interest is, okay, what happens with the regular church folks? Where does that go? What does that do? You know, we might, again, with the recession of modernity, you know, it could very well be that Protestantism lives and dies with the modernity that it facilitated, and sort of like it created modernity around it to inhabit it. And as modernity dies, Protestantism dies too. Maybe, I don't know. But again, these things happen over centuries, and so it's not like Protestantism's going to go away. And it's also that Protestantism deeply impacted the Roman Catholic Church, and Orthodox churches that come to America are going to be deeply impacted by Protestant communities. And again, as I mentioned before, even though in some ways the Anabaptists kept losing battles, some aspects they've kept winning the war. Now, there's my wife. Oops, missed it. I asked her about an hour and a half ago. I said, doing anything yet? Are you done work? Should I make a video? I'm making a video. Oh, that's the end of the video. Just in time. So, yeah, Transformation, Identity, and the New Monasticism. It gets into, you know, my ideas about, okay, and so as I, you know, got going with the Discord server and the YouTube channel, it's like, well, what can this stuff really, what can this stuff really host? And I see a lot of churning. There's churning on the Discord server. People are in it for a year or two or three, and it's like, well, they're kind of exhausted. And you see those normal rhythms in church. People are all excited about church and they're volunteering, and then they got to take a step back. But usually it means, you know, they were here 2-3 days a week doing stuff, and then, well, now they're just here for Sunday services, or they're no longer a small group leader, or they can't be a deacon or an elder right now. Or, I mean, that's normal in terms of the cycles of life. But yeah, we'll see how this goes moving forward. So I don't know quite when I'm going to release this video, because I might have the Peugeot video to release Monday. So I could release it now. It's kind of late. I don't know. You'll know when it's released when I release it. So if you're still watching my channel and you haven't churned out, thanks for watching. Leave a comment. And thank you for your time and attention.